Good morning. This is Nick Geyer. Three disastrous years in Iraq. President Bush has predicted that 75% of Iraq will soon be controlled by Iraqi forces. What he does not tell us is that the loyalty of these police and army units is very uncertain because of ethnic and religious divisions. Last month, reporter Lawrence Kaplan was coming into Tal Afar with a U.S. Army convoy when he witnessed heavy gunfire. He assumed that it was an insurgent attack, but it turned out that it was a skirmish between local police, mostly Sunnis, and the Iraqi army, primarily Shias and Kurds. The Kurds in the north, 90% of whom recently voted for an independent state, still hold their Peshmerga forces, at least 50,000 of them, under their own command. And it's only a matter of time before they take over the largest oil field in the country. Even more troublesome are the Shia militias, who with close ties to Iran control many areas of Iraq. Muqtada al-Sadr, with whom U.S. troops fought pitch battles in 2004, recently returned from a trip to Tehran, where his Iranian sponsors promised continued support for his 10,000-man Mahdi army. It was only 600 men in 2003. Al-Sadr has made his loyalties clear. The Mahdi army is beyond the Iraqi army. It was established to defend Islam. We need to understand that al-Sadr is just not some fringe element. The New Republic has called him Iraq's Dick Cheney, and his followers are expected to get up to 5 cabinet posts in the new government. He is a major player in the United Iraqi Alliance, UIA, which just won the December elections. Another member of the UIA is the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. This group has its own militia, the 12,000-man Badr Corps, which is also financed by the Iranians. Iraq's current interior minister, Bayan Jabr, used to be the head of Badr Corps. Basra, Iraq's third largest city, is essentially under the control of Shia paramilitary units. The head of Basra's police estimates that half of his force has been infiltrated by Shia militants. Basra is the headquarters of 8,500 British troops who, like most Americans, are usually confined to their bases, and they've learned not to intervene against the militias. One Iraqi human rights activist complained that the British Army handed the city to the Islamist groups as a gift. The Bush administration's original goals in Iraq were focused on our own interests, not Iraqi interests. Bush manufactured a case for war based on what he claimed were direct threats to the United States. Building a democratic Iraq was an afterthought to the invasion, and Rumsfeld threw out a well-reasoned State Department plan for Iraqi nation-building. Even if Saddam had kicked out the second group of UN inspectors, we still could have contained him. The no-fly zone in the north would have continued to protect the Kurds, and the one in the south would have shielded the Shias from attack. The second round of inspections was thorough enough to show that Saddam had not rearmed and possessed no WMDs. There was a ruthless logic in the Reagan administration's policy of supporting a secular Iraq against a radically religious Iran. Ironically, a much younger Rumsfeld, overlooking Saddam's gassing of the Kurds and other atrocities, was a willing agent in executing that policy. The Iranians have just elected a president far more radical than previous executives, and we have pushed for Iraqi elections that resulted in the victory of pro-Iranian parties. Bush's war in Iraq has produced the worst possible outcome for our interests in the Middle East. Iraq's oil production is half what it was before the war, and basic utilities such as water, electricity, and sewer are also worse. I wonder how many Iraqis agree with this professor from Basra University, who had this to say on the third anniversary of the war. All in all, our life is worse than when we used to live under Saddam, because now we are under fire. Now we can be killed at any time on the streets. This is Nick Geyer, the Palouse Pundit, wishing you a good day.